the theme of this weekend is really set by a particular teaching, a particular discourse given by the Buddha called the Tango. And so the theme of this weekend is about untangling the Tango. And I'm going to do something over the course of this weekend that I actually haven't done here before in Seattle, which is actually really to explore and to unpack two particular teachings, two particular discourses in the Pali Canon, which really refers to this whole question of how do we untangle our tangles. Now, any of you who are at all familiar with the Pali Canon, this vast collection of teachings given by the Buddha, will probably notice that it's very hard to find coherent themes between particular discourses. They all feel, you know, quite specific and unto themselves. But there is one kind of grouping of discourses in the middle-length sayings which are really pretty much concerned with contemplating the mind and with understanding the nature of our mind. And I think many people feel kind of, people tell me they sort of feel intimidated by this vast collection of discourses and suttas. And, you know, sometimes the language feels a bit awkward and sometimes the phrasing feels a bit awkward. But I think you might discover they're far more accessible and applicable than we might imagine. Untangling the tangle. It's interesting the language that the Buddha uses, because this word untangling is often used interchangeably with the word unbinding. Unbinding. Unbinding is actually a word that's used far more frequently in the early teachings than renunciation. And, you know, any of you who are at all familiar with this path, you know, really can't escape the idea that there's some essence here or some central theme here about renunciation and about unbinding, about untangling. Now, unbinding or untangling is actually a much more user-friendly word. I have to say that. I don't know how you feel about the word renunciation, but doesn't it feel like a sort of very big, momentous word and also kind of puzzling? You know, and we've sort of translated that in Western Dharma culture into this phrase, letting go. You know, and we have this idea about how we should be going through our moments and our days letting go, except we're not quite sure how to do it. And any of you who've ever engaged in that inner command system where you tell yourself to let go of something, or somebody else, some dear friend, tells you it's a good moment to let go of something, know that it actually, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know that it's a kind of spectacular failure to engage in that command system. It's very rarely effective. And yet there's clearly something within us and within our hearts that wants to feel less bound, wants to feel less governed by moods, by views, by opinions, by ideas of self. There's something in us that wants to really, that really longs, I think, to find the way to unbind ourselves from patterns of distress that are created and recreated moment to moment. Unbinding is a process word, isn't it? It's a process word that relates to the moment. It's a process word that relates to all the moments when we find ourselves contracted or in the grip of some obsession or some view or some preoccupation or some tangle that we can't find our way out of. The word in Pali is anupadaya. It really means not clinging to, not clinging to. Learning to have a life of not clinging to. So I want to, what I will do over the course of this weekend is to go into the two suttas that I've chosen in some depth. But I want to begin with the introduction from a different sutta that is called the Tangle. And it goes, a tangle within. Nobody has any problem with the word tangle, by the way, do they? We're all very much got a picture in our mind of what a tangle is. So a tangle within, a tangle without. People are entangled in a tangle. Gautama, I ask you this. Who can untangle this tangle? The Buddha answers, a person established in integrity, developing discernment and mindfulness, ardent and clear, they can untangle this tangle. Those whose passions, aversions, and ignorance have faded away, for them the tangles untangle. Sounds simple. A little bit more challenging in actuality. What really strikes me about this verse is that, you know, these words were spoken 2,600 years ago, where the Buddha lived in a culture not so dissimilar to ours in many ways, that was riven by conflict, by oppression, by greed, by warring sects, by people who found themselves lost. And I think when we open our eyes and our hearts to the world around us, I think it's very easy to despair at the enormity and the complexity of the tangle in our world. And when the Buddha uses the word tangle, also being aware that this is not emotionally neutral. The Buddha refers to tangles as the places where we suffer, the places where we feel disconnected, estranged, alienated, bewildered, lost, and in pain. You know, usually in this teaching, we encourage people not to take things too personally. But today, I want you to take this a little personally, because I don't want this to be just something abstract, as if we are talking about somebody else's mind or somebody else's life. This is a process where we are actually really honestly turning towards the tangles in our own lives, as well as the greater tangles in our world. We look around at the world we live in and see the way it is so fractured by ideologies, by views, by mistrust, by suspicion, by ill will. And then we come a little bit closer to home and look at our own tangles. And where are the tangles that exist in your life just now? They may be clashes with other people, tangles born of our expectations and even our insistence of how things should be or how other people should be. How many tangles in our lives are ribbon or threaded with conflict and misunderstanding and division? And can you find a single tangle in your life that is not painful? That is not painful. This is what the Buddha was really committed to understand. You know, he said very simply, if he summed up his teaching, he says, dukkha is to be understood. Dukkha is to be understood in all its dimensions, unsatisfactoriness, pain, emotional, psychological complexity. dukkha is to be understood. When he talks about the world, the Buddha always talked about the world of experience, the world of our experience. And we all know we live in very different worlds, don't we? One person gets up this morning, you know, looks at the gray skies, thinks, oh, it's a fantastic day to retreat, you know, I'm not off doing something, and has to do something more exciting, you know. Another person looks at the gray skies and here's another brick in the building of my depression where the, you know, the world is so grim, you know. One person sits in the traffic battling and raging with the foolishness of other car drivers, you know. Another person sits in the same traffic jam practicing metta. You know, we live in very, very different worlds. This is our world of experience. And as the Buddha says, that all experience is led by mind, shaped by mind, preceded by mind, that with our thoughts then we make the world, and all that we are is the result of our thoughts. That's a huge statement. This is my world, and it is my world that is being built moment to moment, on the foundations of confusion or on the foundations of understanding. I think of the Buddha as a kind of architect. You know, he was really interested, passionately interested in understanding the architecture of this world. How is our world built? How is our world shaped? Because in the Buddha's eyes, to really understand, deeply understand the architecture of our world is also to deeply understand the architecture of suffering. Because as the Buddha put it very clearly, you know, suffering, pain, struggle, these are not life sentences, these are not static experiences. These are worlds of experience that are being created and recreated, built and rebuilt, moment to moment, and they can be understood. What we see is that our mind and our world of the moment really lives in a state of potentiality. It has the potentiality for great distress and great pain. And it is the same world of the moment. It holds the same depth of potentiality for great clarity, great understanding, and great compassion. So this grouping of suttas in the middle of in the middle length sayings is really dedicated to understanding this architecture of our world, this architecture of our world of experience and our mind, and how it is being built moment to moment. And it's an invitation to us. It's an invitation for us to clearly, gently, passionately actually explore our own world building and the kind of world that we inhabit, because the kind of world of experience that we inhabit becomes the entire world as we see it. Becomes the ground of our responses, our reactions, our views, and this can be understood. So coming back to our tangles, coming a little bit closer to home, the nature of our own tangles just now in our lives, the people we feel estranged from, the relationships where there may be struggles. Sometimes there's family tangles, there's organizational tangles. You know, when I was young and naive as a teacher, you know, I had this dream of, you know, beginning to work in these wonderfully dharmically centered organizations that were going to be free of all of those worldly tangles. Well, guess what? It's not how it works. We take our minds with us everywhere. And we will create tangles everywhere. You notice how generous we are with our tangles? how our tangles overlap and interface with the tangles of others, our expectations, our fears, our anxieties, our attachments, our ill will. We are so generous. We love to invite other people into our tangles. And have you all had the experience of other people being generous with their tangles? Just step right into my world of confusion and conflict. Please enjoy, partake, you know. There's greater suffering in company, you know. Let's just tangle together. And this is really something to recognize, is that we don't tangle alone. Our tangles have major implications in terms of how we interface with one another, how we relate to one another, how we speak to one another, how we engage with this world, this life that doesn't go away. How much our tangles, we see the emotional threads of disappointment, of expectation, of shame, of blame, of wanting. And how these tangles have that flavor of suffering, the flavor of distress. What can change? What can change? And I think this is where it's helpful to take this a little bit personally and not too abstract. What can change? You think of any tangle you're in the moment, any tangle that's touching your life in this moment. And you think, well, what could change? Now, our first response is often, well, if you were just a little bit different, you know, this tangle would be simple to untangle. You know, all you need to do is change, you know, and then life would be great. You know, fit in with my expectations, fit in with my needs, fit in with my images, you know, my ideals, and then the tangle is done. What we see in this world, and it's certainly something I touched upon last night, I think we all recognize the limitations in our power to control the conditions of our world. We cannot control whether the sun shines or not today. You know, we can't control a life where that has only lovely, wonderful people in it, and pleasant sounds, and pleasant sensations, and pleasant smells. This is not within our control. And it really doesn't matter very much, you know, whether we like or dislike the world of conditions. It actually is kind of irrelevant, although we can get very hooked into that. You know, my preferences and my likes and dislikes. The world of conditions is arising and passing according to a whole matrix of conditions, and our control is quite limited. We know that there are limits to our capacity to control or change the course of another person's mind or the pathways that we follow. But we are not helpless. We are not helpless. Because the whole path of transformation, the whole path of awakening, we might say, is through understanding the nature of our own tangles. Then we can ask, what are we bringing to the greater tangles around us? To untangle our own tangles through understanding. You know, the Buddha once said, I know of no one thing that does so much harm as an untrained mind. But that once understood, I know of no one thing that can be a greater friend and a greater ally than a well-trained mind. And this is the path we are engaging in. Understanding the architecture of our worlds. Understanding the way distress is created and recreated moment to moment. But also understanding the ways to the end of distress. The Buddha, I don't know, he had two kind of metaphors that, around two, a lot of metaphors around two basic themes. A lot of the Buddha's metaphors and the teaching are very much agricultural metaphors. You know, they're about growing things, about growing our capacity, about cultivating, about bringing into being. But the other metaphor that he used was a lot around architecture, around building. And there's one wonderful verse. He says, through many births I sought in vain the builder of this house of pain. Now, builder, thee I plainly see. This is the last abode for me. Thy gables yoke and rafters broke. My heart has peace, is awake. This is the end of suffering. I think it's really important to consider that verse because, you know, the Buddha was not a person who despaired. He was a person who actually saw the capacity truly to bring the world of entanglement and the world of distress to an end. And the Buddha sought for graduates. You know, the Buddha did not seek for endless followers and perpetual students. He sought for graduates, for people to come to exactly the same liberating understandings that he had come to. And more I find myself encouraging people not to think of themselves as meditators. Really, I'll say less about that. Not to think of themselves as meditators, but to think of yourself as a student of nibbana. To think of yourself as a student of awakening. And that you are engaged in exactly the same process that the Buddha engaged in. So, we all know what an untrained mind looks like, don't we? Do we need to go into very long descriptions? We could all just kind of fill in the blanks, couldn't we? We know what an untrained mind looks like, you know, governed by impulse and reactivity, lost in preoccupation and obsession, bewildered and mystified about how we end up in the difficult places we end up in, the mind that is not at peace with itself. So what we want to start to look at is, what does a well-trained mind look like? It's interesting, this word training, isn't it? This is like really central in this path. Training the heart, training the mind, a training born of a love of awakening, a training born of a passion for awakening, a training that is undertaken with joy, not with this sense of work that burdens too many Western students, endlessly working on things. It is about cultivating this well-trained heart that knows an inner stillness, a calm, that abides in the Brahma-viharas as their primary home, that has the capacity to think clearly, to think well. When the Buddha talks in one of the discourses in this grouping, when the Buddha talks about the nature of a well-trained mind, he says, this is a person who thinks the thoughts they want to think when they want to think them. And that they don't think the thoughts that are not helpful or they don't want to think at all. Right, there is the bar. There is the bar. That's the aspiration. That's what we're moving towards, to understanding the process of our own mind. And I say that process of our own mind so very specifically because it is a process, okay? Mind is a process. It would be better to use the word minding, the minding of the moment. So often we tend to think of the mind as this kind of frozen, this static thing, and we tend to think of it as mine, you know, my mind. You know, my mind is such a problem. You know, my mind is so confused. You know, my mind is so lost. You know, it is not my mind. Mind is a process constantly being shaped by such a range of different factors. Shaped by somatic experience, shaped by thoughts, shaped by moods, shaped by attitudes and by views. If you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta we often work with in insight meditation, and the section of being mindful of the mind, the Buddha speaks about the mind affected by greed, the mind non-affected by greed, the mind affected by aversion, the mind not affected by aversion, the mind affected by clinging, the mind not affected by clinging. So the Buddha's speaking, inviting us to be aware of the shaping process. And what is shaping the mind of this moment? Right now, for you. What is shaping the minding of this moment? Is it boredom? Is it curiosity? Is it dullness? Is it aversion? What is shaping the minding of this moment? And we should never think that we don't have choices within that shaping. Because this is the gift of sati. It's the gift of mindfulness that we can actually choose in any moment not only what we attend to, but we can choose in any moment how we attend. This is our choice of the moment. Okay, so I'm going to pause there for just a moment just to see if there's any questions before I actually begin to look at this first discourse. Yes, please.
In the beginning you said something about the habit of proliferation.
Yes.
Way back. What is that?
The habit of proliferation is a habit of obsession.
Okay.
Okay. And that actually is going to be the primary discourse I'm going to look at tomorrow. A habit of obsession, and being aware that in terms of Buddhist psychology, the word obsession is used really as this tendency to engage in repetitive thinking. You know, and as far as the Buddha was concerned, you know, most people with an untrained mind are suffering with some OCD. You know, just the tendency to repeat in thought. And you know, in terms of Buddhist psychology, obsession is basically having the same thought more than twice. Yeah. Yes, please.
I get a little bit confused, well, maybe not a little bit, but comparing accepting what's going on and then choosing to do something different, I get stuck in just accepting and really don't think it's right, I guess, is what I told myself to choose.
Well, I mean, this whole kind of philosophy around acceptance, you know, it's a very prickly bugbear in a way. It's almost an import, I think, from Western psychology. And it's understandable because we actually see how many people live a life of resistance and denial and judgment and pushing away. It's not so much a word that features so strongly in Buddhist psychology on one level, but another level it does. Because you think about the first movement of sati or mindfulness is to meet the moment as it is. We could use the word acceptance for that, you know, to meet the moment as it is without the extra layers of, you know, how it should be or dislike or aversion or narrative, to actually turn towards and meet the moment as it is with an attitude of curiosity and befriending. We could call that acceptance. I think that's a better definition of acceptance. But of course, that's only the very first dimension of mindfulness. It's a necessary one. It's the absolutely first foundational necessary dimension of mindfulness, but it is the first dimension of mindfulness. And I think where people get confused is that acceptance becomes the end of the story. And then it can feel almost like a sort of, it's near enemy of a certain passivity. You know, or disengagement, you know, it's just how it is, you know, just watching it. The world has often not helped a great deal by that kind of passivity. Our world, our personal world, is not necessarily helped a great deal by passivity. And one really has to acknowledge that mindfulness lives within a very extended, happy family. There's not only the other three dimensions of mindfulness. There's the way that mindfulness is engaging with skillful effort, with integrity, with the Brahma-viharas, with equanimity, you know, with energy, with wise action, you know, with all of these things. So that level of acceptance, as I've talked about, that's the very first step. Then, of course, the entire path of training and development is built upon being able to know things just as they are at the moment. And almost the next question then is, what is being cultivated? What we practice will grow, you know? What we dwell upon will grow, and we can choose, actually, where we make our home and what we cultivate on the basis of that turning towards knowing things as they are with friendliness and with curiosity. It is a first step. It's a first step.
If I go through that and I understand, then my effort will not look like that.
No power.
Yeah.
Are you all hearing the question? Okay, so the question is that, you know, some unease around where cultivation kind of morphs into a kind of willpower, which is often a kind of disguised aversion. You know, cultivation in the path of awakening doesn't have anything to do with willpower, where willpower often has quite a centralized sense of self, what I want to make happen. You know, what I want to make change, you know. And so willpower has plenty of effort in it, but the effort in it is often kind of surrounded or founded upon this sense of forcing into how things need to be and how things should be. And the question was, you know, perhaps moving to not staying long enough with that place of turning towards and befriending what is actually going on, moving too quickly into the fix-it mode, which is a kind of, you know, curse of many people's minds, isn't it? You know, that something's not right in our tangle and I'm going to fix it. And there is actually a place for very much keeping one's finger on the pulse, not only of the effort we make, but the quality of effort we make and what it's really dedicated to. You know, are the efforts we make dedicated to kind of rearranging the tangle so I'm not so disturbed? Or are the efforts we make really dedicated to understanding the tangle and unbinding? Okay, please go on. I mean, the Buddha put it very clearly. To that which our minds frequently inclined, this we will become. To that which our minds frequently incline, this we will become. That's actually a pretty profound statement. Now, the mind inclines. The mind can incline quite habitually, and the mind can incline quite intentionally. If the mind inclines quite habitually to ill will, to aversion, to fear, to anxiety, this the mind will become. This will become the shape of our mind. There's often very little in there that is intentional. It's a habit. In moving into the much bigger sense of what it is that we value, a dedication to bringing suffering to an end, we really ask that question very seriously of ourselves. To what does our mind most frequently incline? And in this, the Buddha says, of course, this is where the element of intention actually comes in. We're planting the seeds of inclining the mind towards kindness, towards compassion, towards understanding, towards peace, and this too will become the shape of the mind. Recognizing that we're inclining the mind is not something new to us. It has been with us through our lives. But the inclining without understanding tends to be a habitual inclining that's very much part of the fabric of creating and recreating distress. Okay, shall we move on a little bit? Okay. So I want to start with this first discourse. And part of that is that I'm going to read it to you. Because I don't want this to be in the abstract. And then we're going to unpack it a little bit. So there's the usual context, there's the usual framing of a discourse that starts with, thus have I heard. By the way, the name of this sutta, the name of this discourse, is Two Kinds of Thought. Two Kinds of Thought. Starts with, thus have I heard. And this then is the Buddha teaching a group of students. He says, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, before my awakening, while I was still only an unenlightened, unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes or two kinds. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, and I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will or metta, and thoughts of non-cruelty or compassion. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. And I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction. This leads to others' affliction and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. When I considered thus, when I considered thus, this leads to my own affliction, the thought subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided me in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So this is the beginning of the sutta. Now there's much in this first introduction to reflect on. I think one of the things to reflect on is this sense of what leads to affliction. What are the thoughts that are unconducive to our well-being? What are the thoughts that are unconducive to the well-being of those around us? What are the thoughts that lead to affliction in both? Now, noticing here that mindfulness has moved into a different phase. It's moved into this phase of discernment and investigation. Here it begins with actually the thoughts of sensual desire, the thoughts of ill will, the thoughts of cruelty, But it begins particularly with focusing on the thoughts of sensual desire. Does that really seem like such a big problem to you, I'm wondering? Seems kind of benign a lot of times, doesn't it? Either I'm going to have a little pleasant fantasy, or I'm going to have a little thought about, you know, what's in my lunch bag, you know, or I'm going to have a little thought about my next vacation, or, you know, it doesn't seem that bad, does it? So why does that lead to your affliction? Why could that possibly lead to the affliction of others and to the affliction of both? I'm posing a series of questions here. I want you just to think about them for a moment. When do thoughts of sensual desire arise in you? Do thoughts of sensual desire arise in you in your most contented, happy, sufficient moments? Or the thoughts of some future happiness or some other happiness arise in us in times of greatest disconnection or in times of greatest discontent? Can we see how those very small, seemingly benign thoughts of sensual desire are really kind of the arms and legs of the whole body of the mind that gets lost in greed? Can we see that thoughts of sensual desire tell us something about how we posit the source of happiness outside of ourselves, in things, in objects, in pleasant events, in pleasant experiences? Can we see how thoughts of sensual desire tell us something about some present moment sense of lack or insufficiency? So what feels quite benign, and in many ways, you know, that little thought about what's in my lunch bag, it actually is not devastating the world. But it is part of the paradigm of greed. It's part of that spectrum of the kind of hungry ghost mind. But it's also part of externalizing happiness and joy outside of ourselves and living in a state then of impoverishment. Does this lead to our affliction? Yes, I think it does. Does it lead to the affliction of others? Very often, how much of the world is trampled in the service of our sensual desires? Does it lead to the affliction of both? Does being aware of this mean that somehow we suffocate or suppress our capacities for appreciation and delight and for our hearts to be touched by the lovely? Absolutely not. This is talking about the orientation of the mind. And it's talking about a number of different things. It's talking about discernment. This is quality of discernment. Does this lead towards freedom? Or does it lead away from freedom? Does this thought of sensual desire, does it obstruct understanding? Or does it lead to understanding? This is the kind of discernment we're actually asked to apply in contemplating our own minds. There is something very, very big difference between discernment and what we call judgment. Discernment is developing and honing and refining our own inner capacity to sense what it is that leads to distress and suffering and what it is that leads to the end of distress and suffering. So it's a very clear element in even the introduction to this about the primary place that this discerning capacity plays in the pathway of awakening. But this is also about ethics, isn't it? It's about an ethical way of being in this world, where we're dedicated to not causing affliction, to not being a sort of part of the architecture of affliction, where we're actually asking not only where do our actions arise from, but where do our thoughts arise from. Now, the Buddha seemed to do really quite well in this, because he just saw this, and the thought of sensual desire subsided. When ever, then, a thought of sensual desire re-arose in him, he abandoned it and removed it and did away with it. There's something in here, I think, when we, you know, much of our minds happen at such great speed, don't they? Much of our minding happens at such great speed that we're hardly ever there at that point of, oh, a thought of sensual desire is arising in me. We are already at the lunch counter, you know. We have already moved so fast. You know, we're already on the behavioral element of that thought. So clearly, in terms of a well-trained mind, the Buddha is speaking about developing that inner sensitivity and that inner curiosity that we're actually caring for the nature of our thoughts and caring from where they arise, so that we're not always on this kind of retrospective awareness, you know, of maybe I didn't need to kind of jump so quickly into satisfying that particular desire. Perhaps I could actually really pause for a moment and actually sense, where is this arising from and where does it lead to me? And in sense of it being fairly benign, of course it feels fairly benign on one level, but that isn't that part of habit building? Things start out feeling fairly benign and then we realize we're in the grip of it. You know, it's kind of like maybe an alcoholic who thought, you know, that first drink was pretty benign, just hanging out with friends, you know. On one level it is. And then how did that happen, that suddenly I need that tenth one? Or how did that happen, that suddenly I'm lost in this particular inclining of the mind of need and lack and sensual desire being the way that I gratify and I satisfy myself and soothe myself, comfort myself in moments of discontent. So the Buddha actually became a little bit much more forceful in this introductory paragraph, didn't he? Whenever a thought of, when he says, when he actually saw that this leads to my affliction, and to the affliction of others, or the suffering of others, when he saw that this thought leads away from nibbana, obstructs wisdom, and causes difficulties, when he actually saw this and considered this, the thought subsided. The thought passed away. It didn't mean that it didn't re-arise, did it? Didn't mean that this was a one-off event, you know? And then he talks, then, when the thought arose in me, I abandoned it. I abandoned it. I removed it. I did away with it. Does that sound terribly forceful to you? Or what could be the mind that's behind that, that says, I know this. I know this. I know where this thought goes. You know, this is no surprise to me. I've walked down this pathway how many times in my life? Now I see it's a habit. The mind has been shaped in this way. Here, I actually abandon it. You know, I think we tend to use the word abandonment in our culture in the very negative way that people have experienced abandonment, you know, of just being ignored and pushed away and neglected. But the Buddha is using the word abandonment here as a virtue. I abandon it. What does that mean? actually, I withdraw my consent from it. You know, what is so, I think, so important for us to see is that there is no thought and there is no mental state or mood that has an independent self-existence. That for any mental state, any mood, any thought to begin to turn into a narrative or into a story requires our consent and our participation. Withdrawing consent is often how I think of this term, abandonment. Just not playing with this one more time. You know? Why? Because I know where it goes. I know this leads to my affliction, to the affliction of others, and to the affliction of both. Does that make sense to you? Okay. I asked you a whole bunch of questions.
I was just thinking that another way.
There's the questions, what about dreams at night? This is just the mind that is disconnected from conscious reality, so has lots of bizarre images. But emotional tones in our dreams are often the same as in our waking states, you know. So we actually see the addiction, you know, and the pursuit of sensual desire in our dreams and our fantasies as much as we do in our waking moments. The emotional tone is often revealing, actually, some of the kind of core inclinations of our minds.
So if we practice consciously, then the dreams should
change
as well?
Yes, of course. If your conscious mind changes, your dream mind changes too. Yes, please.
So basically, what came up was if your daydream.
It is absolutely necessary. I mean, it's just, the speed of our lives is often reflecting the speed of our minds. And, you know, mindfulness does not stand much chance in that kind of frenzy, you know. And it's not that we can all choose to retire and sit in a mountaintop, you know. Things are asking to be done. Families are asking to be attended to, you know. The world needs our participation. But the world doesn't need our agitation. Does not benefit from our agitation. And, you know, it is part of, I think, the responsibility. But I think what the Buddha is actually speaking about here in this discernment of what leads to affliction and what leads to the end of affliction, he is speaking about metta, he is speaking about compassion, he is speaking about what is actually the kindest, clearest way to be in this world for the benefit of ourselves and the benefit of others. I mean, the question was around how identity is central to all of this, both in positive, seemingly positive ways and seemingly unhelpful ways, you know, and how identity is a narrative producer and identity is a world builder, you know, in that verse I read you, this is the house builder. Identity is the house builder, who I am, who I believe myself to be, and I build the world on the basis of that. You know, and some of it seems quite positive and some of it seems quite unhelpful, but actually the whole propensity to create a view of self is always unhelpful, whether it is positive or negatively built. The Buddha doesn't make any distinction between those two. And this is actually much more the subject of tomorrow. Okay. So I'll read a little bit more and then we'll actually have a break. And the Buddha goes on, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me, a thought of cruelty arose in me. I understood this. This thought of ill will and cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. It's very important. The Buddha is centralizing three primary aspects of experience here. One of them is craving, one of them is ill will, and the other one is clinging. He says these are the three aspects, the three we might call unwise intentions that are central, that they're kind of the gas in the car, they're the fuel that keeps the wheel of distress spinning. Craving for sensual desire, ill will, and clinging. When the Buddha speaks about the three centralized intentions that are truly at the heart of transformation, they are three simple ones. Remember that intention and thought are interchangeable concepts. Okay? The thoughts of metta, the thoughts of compassion, and the thoughts of unbinding or non-clinging. That is the challenge of our path. To move from that field of thinking of ill will and greed and cruelty and clinging to a mind that is really abiding in metta, in compassion, in non-clinging. That is the challenge of our path. And not just as some future moment, one has to really ground that in the actuality of this moment. Because this moment, thoughts and intentions are present. The next moment, thoughts and intentions are present. There is no moment of our life, except when it's kind of clouded by numbness or dullness, when thoughts and intentions are not present. And we see that they have a family. All of our thoughts and intentions have a family. The family of our speech, the family of our actions, the family of how we engage with the world. So all experience is led by mind, shaped by mind. This is then actually translated into how we speak, what we speak, how we engage, how we act, what we choose. This is a kind of really, I think, phenomenal shift that the Buddha is inviting us to make from the mind that is kind of, you know, locked or rooted in those most habitual core elements of distress making, to the mind that is actually rooted in these core intentions and thoughts that are leading to the end of distress for ourselves and for others. Is that quite simply clear?